EDP, EFS, BitLocker, RMS, DAC, and IPSec, or how to protect your files at rest and in transit. So let's frame the problem. We know that files are often emailed to the wrong person. We've all got the wrong file from the wrong person. Or we've got the wrong file from the right person. A survey of CIOs found that up to 70% admitted that they have emailed data to the wrong person. We saw this a couple of months back, where we had some people who had organised the Leaders Summit in Brisbane emailing the passport information of world leaders to a journalist at The Australian by mistake. And this is people that admitted that they stuffed up. Because I'm pretty sure if someone rang you and said, hello, Mr. Systems or Mrs. Systems Administrator, have you ever emailed a file to the wrong person? And you're like, nah, I am great. I've never, ever made that mistake. But my friend Macca, well. Now, here's an interesting question for you. Who here in this room is absolutely sure that all of the file share permissions in their organisation are correctly configured? Who's willing to stand up and say, yes, I am absolutely 100% certain that I've got this right? Yes, well, I'm quite glad that no one got up, because I would have been, wow, the chosen one. Who here is sure that SharePoint permissions are configured to ensure that data can only be accessed by people who is meant to access it? Again, you sit there and go, well, I kind of hope it is, but I kind of do understand the possibility that somewhere along the line that these permissions aren't correctly configured. Now, who here has lost a USB stick containing important files, or who here has worked with someone who has lost a USB stick containing important files? Now, even if you don't feel bad about this, there was a survey done. There's a group called the Ponymon Institute, and it's not like My Little Pony people. It's just the name of the guy's Ponymon. I'd change that if I was him. But they do some really cool research into stuff like security and mobility, and they publish these amazing reports on things like the number of USB sticks or laptops that are lost, because they can go through government data where this has got to be admitted. And they found one year that the Ministry of Defence in England reported that they had lost 70 laptops and over 500 USB sticks containing data that was potentially sensitive in a 12-month period. So this is the Ministry of Defence in the UK, which you would sort of expect to have fairly good security practices. So if these guys are stuffing up like that, it's not unreasonable to think that people who work at perhaps organisations where the security of information is considered less critical may be similarly having problems. Who here has had a colleague lose their laptop or tablet? Anybody had people I work with lose? So here's an interesting stat. In the United States, each week, 3,000 laptops are left at airport security check-ins. That is, when people are going through security, 3,000 a week are left. And the way that they know this is after a three-month period, one, there's mandatory reporting, after a three-month period, roughly only 15% of those laptops are actually retrieved by the people that own them, and the rest are sold by the TSA. So the TSA has this wonderful little side thing going where people leave laptops for them and they sell them, and then they can go and employ more TSA agents. They could train the TSA agents better, but, you know, that's a particular choice. There was also another interesting stat more a couple of years ago, doesn't apply as much now, where they found that the numbers really spiked the week before any new MacBook Pros were released. Correlation, causation, you figure it out. Who here has users who store important files on their mobile devices? Right, mobile devices are fairly easy to use. We're now carrying around storage devices in our pocket that can store more data than when I started as a systems administrator, an entire faculty of one of the biggest universities in the country had stored on their file shares. Who here knows if any of their users are storing organizational files in things like Dropbox or OneDrive? Who here suspects that their users might be doing that? Who here knows if users email sensitive files to their private email accounts? This sort of stuff happens all the time. And where I'm going with this is that we can't necessarily secure the location in which the file has been stored. This has been our approach for a long time, is that what we'll do is we'll put file permissions on something, and we will hope that if it's stored in a particular location and it's stored securely, that that'll keep it all secure. Instead, our approach is moving towards encrypting the securing the contents of the file. That is, that we can't stop people moving a file around, but perhaps what we can do is we can stop people who are not authorized from opening that file. Now, this doesn't mean that we don't try and secure the place where the file is stored. It's not like we throw up our hands and say, well, we've given up on NTFS permissions. We've given up on stopping people from losing their laptop. We're giving up on all of these things. It's just, if with anything, it's, you know, it's defense in depth. It's security is an onion. You've got so many layers that you've got to deal with. Onions, donkeys, sorry, Shrek. No file can ever be 100% protected. Understand that nothing can be 100% protected. That's not your job as someone who's thinking about security in your organisation. What the job is to make sure that you have taken all possible steps to secure information. You can make it almost impossibly difficult for non-authorised access to occur. And really, part of this is a CYA scenario, because you don't want to be in that meeting where you're explaining why you didn't take obvious basic steps. Okay, there is leaving the barn door open. If you've put a lock on the barn door and the barn door's shut and someone breaks in, that's a lot more defensible and that's a lot more reasonable set of steps to take. And if someone then takes extraordinary steps to get into the barn, well, within reason, you've done what you could. Because one of the things that you find when you're reading through security breach information, when you're reading about a lot of these attacks, is that the attackers, except in very unusual circumstances, are not particularly sophisticated. They're hitting low-hanging fruit. Okay, it's not Tom Cruise Mission Impossible type penetration. That does happen, but it happens so rarely that you don't need to worry about it. It's a statistical anomaly. The most common attacks are using simple, basic security misconfigurations. So let's learn how we can get to the stage where we're making it almost impossibly difficult for non-authorized access to occur. Now, let's talk about files that are stored on file shares. This is probably primarily where the majority of your files in your organisations are stored. Now, even experienced administrators have problems correctly applying share, folder, and file permissions. When I have taught, I teach occasionally with DDLS, and I go and discuss file and folder permissions, even with people at places like the Defence Signals Directorate, I find that if I go and get them to configure things, sometimes they get it wrong. Simply because working out the calculus of file and folder permissions is needlessly complex. And if you're a bit distracted, you can stuff it up. To give another more perhaps obvious example of this, users certainly surf file shares. This is one of your internal attacks that occurs. Users are basically just bored. They're not doing what they want. They're not filling out those TPS reports. What they're doing sometimes is they're just browsing around to see what they can find. because you know that there's so much unsecured data. I mean, my wife is today not very technical, but she says, oh, you know, by the way, all of the executive spreadsheets on my organisation's file shares have no security on them, and everybody in the organisation can read what salary the people that run the company get. And I'm thinking, well, that's very good, isn't it? It's a lot of interesting information for the water cooler. But think of it this way. Bradley, Chelsea Manning, was able to access files. So all of that stuff that ended up with Julian Assange was got by someone who was basically kind of almost working a help desk role, sitting in an office, surfing file shares. And all that person was doing was just grabbing stuff down, burning it onto CD, and taking it home. And when they had enough, they handed it, in theory, I don't know what the statement is about the legalities of making an accusation because it hasn't gone through a court, handed it over, and then it was published through Julian Assange on WikiLeaks. This was not a sophisticated attack. It was simply that the state, but US State Department, had confidential diplomatic information sitting on file shares with permissions that were not configured correctly. A user only needs to have read access to a file to be able to copy it. And people kind of go, oh, well, they can't modify the file. Great, they can't modify the file. That's fantastic. They can still read it. And if you can copy a file, you can strip it of all of its permissions. For example, you could copy it to a FAT32 formatted USB key. If you've got read access to a file, copy it to a USB key, all the permissions are stripped. The amount of time required for you to manually apply correct permissions is cost prohibitive. It's too complicated for you to manually do it because you've got to work out exactly who needs access, and that's often not some information that you are given. You have to spend an insane amount of time figuring out what the permissions should be, and you then have to spend time correctly applying those permissions. Now, there is a solution. There's dynamic access control. Now, what dynamic access control does is it allows for the automatic assignment of permissions on a file based on the properties of that file. For example, you can assign metadata. So there's those of you who've looked into Windows, even back to Windows Server 2003. But with Server 2012, File Server Resource Manager, which is a tool that's been in Windows Server since Server 2003, came with a tool to apply metadata to files. And the way that this works is it's called a file classification task. And what it does is it can look at the contents of the file, it can look at who wrote the file, it can look at any property of the file that the file has, and then can apply metadata to that file. For example, if a file contains the word hovercraft, you could automatically have the classification, the metadata classification secret, applied to that file. What dynamic access control does is that you then set up a bunch of rules in Active Directory that literally say, if the word secret is associated with a file's metadata, automatically apply this set of permissions to the file. So you're getting away from, I need to manually go and apply these permissions to files, to this file has these properties, which are automatically applied by the system, and then gets these permissions that are automatically applied. So you can automatically have, if someone authors, the CEO authors a document, you can automatically have permissions applied to that document without the CEO ever having to look at an NTFS permission. Because can you imagine if systems administrators are having problems understanding NTFS permissions, the kind of problems that your average non-technical user is going to have understanding NTFS permissions? But the problem with dynamic access controllers is challenging to deploy. I'm not going to muck around here. There's a lot of work where you've got to basically sit down and work out what all of your classifications are. And most of you aren't thinking about the information in your organization that way. You are simply not thinking, okay, how should we be protecting information? Because up until now, it's not been considered as important. But what we're seeing on Pastebin on a regular basis is people dumping organisational data that should be internal to that organisation. Sometimes people confuse it with hacktivism, but you're seeing a lot more with millennials, especially, who have a very different attitude to what perhaps baby boomers have about people like Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, is that if they feel wronged by a company, they have no compunction whatsoever about going and publishing that company's secrets. And as we know, there was a guy named Cardinal Reichenau who said, give me six lines written by the most innocent of men and I will find you enough to hang them by. If your organisation or any organisation is just having gigabytes of data dumped into the public, someone's going to find something, you know, in that data to assassinate them on social media. Incorrectly applied SharePoint permissions. It's a similar problem to file permissions. Now, where SharePoint is interesting in this narrative is that General Keith Alexander, who is basically the head of, I think he's even more than that now, but was the head of the NSA, said in his report to Congress that Edward Snowden was able to get access to all of this information that he then took on three laptops across to China because he was able to sit there and surf SharePoint. And he wrote spidering jobs that would just go through, spider, and basically recursively wget all of the information that was sitting on SharePoint sites. He didn't know what he was getting. He just wrote a whole lot of spiders that went out and just sucked the network dry. He was an administrator, but he was a low-level administrator. He should simply never have had access. And this is something else that we're going to get to. If you were in my previous talk, I said that one of the things that the NSA says that you do is you hack the administrator. So someone who is trying to get data out of your organisation, even if they're internal to your organisation, knows that the person that they target is the administrator, because the administrator may have given themselves rights to access any data in the organisation. There was a survey done about 15 years ago where they asked server administrators if they had ever looked at data using their permissions that they shouldn't have. Who here would like to guess how many admitted that they'd done it? Pardon? Oh, no, okay, no. So I think systems administrators were a bit more honest back then. So let's assume that everybody was being honest. Who would like to now guess what the permission percent were? Yeah, almost 100, okay? Because server administrators were simply like, it's my server, I'll go and look at whatever I want. There's been at least a change in that. It's not like, oh, cool, let's go and find out what the CEO makes, or oh, I wonder what he's talking about today. I'm bored. We're not all the BOFH from the register anymore. We just hide it a lot better. But we're all of that generation. Now, files accidentally sent by email. We see this a lot. It's something that we can stop. Or files deliberately sent by email. That's something that we can also stop. There are tools. Files that are stored on removable media that is lost or stolen. These are all things that we need to have a plan for. If you have access to removable media, then you have access to the files if it's not properly protected. And people are losing removable media all the time. Now, your first strategy, one that some people think of, is they go, well, you know what I can do? I can get people to put a password on any sensitive file. That is not a bad very first answer to this question. It does provide protection for the file. In fact, if you go and look on your favourite search engine for how do I crack the password protection on a Word file, there are a lot of hits or an Excel spreadsheet, and there's a lot of tools that apparently will do it, but what they'll really do is turn your computer into a node for a Russian botnet. Because people forget their passwords, and Microsoft's official advice is if you've forgotten your password, you've lost access to the contents of the file. The file simply does become unrecoverable. Even though people are out there claiming, yeah, I can recover it, and what it might do is it might go through and check because we've got lists of the most commonly used passwords. It might check the top 10,000 passwords against the file. But if you've got a really good password, you're never getting, and you've forgotten it, you're never getting back into that file. And that's always the problem with passwords, isn't it? If it's a really good password, it's almost impossible to remember. If it's easy to remember, probably not a very good password. One of the reasons that systems administrators, someone once explained to me, and I thought that this was wonderful in how they were getting around their, what they should have done, because he said, oh, look, I don't want to change my password on a regular basis. And I said, why? And he said, well, I put a lot of creative effort into my password. And I feel that, you know, having to change something that I've created on a regular basis, sort of, you know, of all of soul-crushing things that I have to deal with at work, having to change something, you know, an expression of my creativity is just a step too far. And I went, well, that's the best BS answer I've heard to the problem of password changes in a long time. Now, files protected by a password also become completely unrecoverable if the user suffers an unrecoverable end of existence event. They're not dead, they're pining for the fjords. But you'd be surprised. When there's been disasters occur, natural disasters occur, and people are killed, some organisations are really up the creek because they can't get access to password-protected files because the user's obviously no longer with us. That needs to be something you need to think about, because any protection solution that you put in place must allow authorised, and this is the key here, must allow authorised users to be able to recover data. It isn't necessarily just important from a business continuity perspective. Who here has ever been subject to a legal discovery request where they've got to go and recover a bunch of user data, okay? So there's quite a few of you. This is becoming, again, one of these issues, and it's odd that we don't really have too many talks about this at Ignite. But this is one of these issues where we've, as systems administrators, got to go in and recover data because there's a legal case or there's an internal HR investigation. And we find out very quickly in those situations whether or not policies exist around it. And what you don't want to be in that situation is sitting there ad hocing it and going, oh, well, I'll do what I think I do. Literally, if HR comes to you and says, well, you've got to do this, you come back and say, okay, what's the policy and procedure on this? Because I want to be covered, because I'm obviously going and looking at things that, in theory, I shouldn't be. Now, who here thinks that they've got good policy in their organisation around this? Okay, a lot less people. So isn't that interesting? But if your organisation is subject to legal discovery, judges are unlikely to look favourably on organisations that argue that documents can't be handed over because they're encrypted. We're seeing this at the moment with US law enforcement and iPhones. Apple's basically said, we can't recover an iPhone if someone doesn't give you the password. And law enforcement is panicking about this because they're saying, no, 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 we need a back door. And here we've got a great tension between an individual's assumed right to privacy and the ability for a legal authority that has appropriate legal power to actually get access to certain data. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Data protection is awesome until IT pros end up incarcerated because of contempt of court. And this has happened. There's been IT pros that have served time in jail simply because they have not released protected data. You may remember the case of a San Francisco network administrator who was in charge of the network equipment for the city of San Francisco, who refused to hand over passwords because he thought that the person he was handing over the passwords to was thoroughly incompetent and was going to ruin his network configuration. So that's a case that happened. The guy ended up in jail because eventually he handed them over to the mayor because the mayor came to him and said, look, you've got to give me these things. But, you know, this guy was kind of like protecting his job and things like that. But this does happen. Now, encrypting file system. Encrypting file system is a technology that debuted with Windows 2000. But it's not really a solution. Let me talk about what it is, and then let me explain why you don't want to use it. And in fact, why it's probably going to be deprecated in its current form at some point in the future, completely. So basic EFS, you've got the private and the public key stored on the local computer. You right click on a file, you go to the properties and you encrypt the file. The idea being that someone else that shares the computer can't get access to the file unless they've got the private key. The private key is stored with your user account, so if you're logged on, you can get it, but if you're sharing the computer and someone else logs on, they can't get access to it because they don't have access to that private key. You can export the private key, you can give the private key to them, and that gives them access. The private key stored with the user account. Now, understanding this means understanding that a file encrypted with a public key can only be decrypted with a private key. It does require NTFS, which at the start, when this was deployed, you still had people running Windows XP, and a lot of people who ran Windows XP initially weren't using NTFS with Windows XP. Now, and if an EFS encrypted file is copied to an NTFS formatted USB stick, everything is great because it's a property of EFS. You copy it across and it remains encrypted on the USB stick. That's fine for that use case scenario, except for you will notice the problem with that phrase, properly formatted USB stick. Who here suspects that even 50% of their USB sticks are formatted NTFS? Who thinks that they're all formatted FAT32? Right. So the misconception about EFS is that the file remains encrypted when you copy it to FAT32. It does not. What happens is if you go and copy an EFS encrypted file across to a FAT32 volume, it decrypts. If you email an EFS encrypted file, it decrypts. The moment you attach it, it decrypts and gets sent because EFS encryption only works if the file is at rest on that storage. The moment it moves off that storage, the file's no longer encrypted. It's an encryption of the medium. It's not an encryption of the contents of the file. And I have seen really senior people, like at my first tech ed, I was watching Steve Riley over in Theatre Arena 2, and he said, oh, if I email an EFS encrypted file, it's protected. And I'm sort of sitting there going, wait a second, this is Steve Riley. How does he not know that this is not true? And I went down to the speaker lounge and my first time, I walked up to him, I said, hi, Steve. That's wrong. And he said, no, it's not. And I said, okay, email me an EFS encrypted file and I'll show you that I can open it. And he did, and he went, oh, I didn't understand that. And I'm thinking, how did you not understand that? You're Steve Riley. That was a misconception. Now, here's another wonderful one about EFS. If you copy an EFS encrypted file off your local workstation onto a file share, it decrypts, copies itself across the network in plain text, and then re-encrypts on the file server. So if you've got some clever little duck who's sitting on your network intercepting traffic, they get access to the file, unless you've got something like IPsec. Another misconception about EFS is that data is simply not recoverable. And this is a misconception because the default administrator account on the local computer always has access to the contents of an EFS encrypted file unless you go in and change policy. Similarly, the default domain administrator account has access to EFS encrypted data by default unless you go and change the policy. So that meant if someone had EFS encrypted a file, all someone else had to do was get access to the first administrator account in the domain, and then they could go and read it. You have to go and change this, and this is in the group policy. You can see here that I've got it's configured as EFS recovery is configured for the administrator account. Now, what you should do if you are using EFS, and my recommendation is really that you don't, is that you would change who the default recovery account is. You would literally go and issue a certificate to another account. You'd remove the administrator account. You'd go and put that certificate in a safe, and the only time it get pulled out of the safe was when you had one of those HR policy compliant mandated recovery options where you're allowed to go and recover that data. So to add that, you go add recovery data recovery agent, you import the certificate, you specify the certificate you're going to allow, and then you've got your data recovery certificate. And that's all you have to do. The person then who is the owns a data recovery certificate is the only person that can go and access that. Because the default administrator account's not something we really think a lot about because we've all got our own domain admins accounts. But it actually turns out there's a whole lot of stuff in Windows that works and is allowed to work with that particular account. And what you kind of want to do is you want to get to the stage where you've actually disabled that account and that you don't light it up unless there's a really, really, really good reason to do so, because it's one of those security points of failure in a domain. Advanced EFS. Now, with an advanced EFS implementation, you can go and put Active Directory certificate services in. And instead of the machines generating their own EFS keys, what happens is they go out to the certificate authority and they pull an EFS key down there. This is the best way to do EFS if you've decided that you are going to do EFS. The reason that it's the best way to do EFS is that when you're using a certificate authority, you can move from that model of what's called a data recovery agent. With a data recovery agent, every file that's encrypted with EFS is encrypted to the user's key and the data recovery agent's key. So that was the one I just showed you back here. In an advanced EFS scenario, what you say is that there is no data recovery agent, but there's a key recovery agent. So what happens then is if, say, Simone leaves the organisation and leaves a whole lot of EFS encrypted files on her workstation, instead of having a data recovery agent to access those files, because the problem with a data recovery agent is it's like a Superman or Superwoman account. It can do everything. What you want to do is you want to have a certificate that can just recover Simone's files, but no one else's. Because again, if you've got one of these certificates that can go and do everything, that's a point where someone's going to attack you and go, I want to get access to that certificate because it gives me access to all the encrypted data. Whereas if you've got a key recovery agent, what happens is that someone goes to the CA and says, okay, I'm going to export Simone's private key and then I can just recover her data. And there's a whole process around doing that and it makes it slightly more secure. Okay, so the way you do that is you go and edit the properties of the CA and you go and configure a key recovery agent. You issue a special key recovery agent certificate, you change the properties of the CA, you restart the CA, and then every certificate that's issued by the CA at that point, you can recover, if you've got the right passwords and so on, you can recover that CA from the certificate from the database. You also need to change the properties of your EFS templates to allow the private key to be exported and archive the subject's encryption private key, which simply means that a copy is kept in the certificate services database. Now, here is a really unfortunate truth, and it's one you probably already suspect, and it's one that I've already talked about in a previous session at this event. Many of the most devastating attacks against organisations have been perpetrated by server administrators. Okay, Edward Snowden was the NSA's nightmare because Edward Snowden was an authorised insider. And one of the big changes in thinking that you are going to see in the next decade is that the authorised insider who has unlimited power is going to have that power mostly stripped away from them. It's going to be very much more a you can use this particular power under these circumstances and no more. No more can you do everything that you want to do, because we've seen what happens when we let people do everything that they want to do. We end up with an amazing amount of NSA data in an organisation that should be able to protect itself against this being leaked. So if that's happening at the NSA, imagining it happening at health insurance organisations or hospitals or all of these other places that have all of this sensitive data. So a key component of an effective data protection in strategy involves leashing systems administrators. With great power, of course, comes great responsibility, and unfortunately, systems administrators do tend to be psychologically probably more on the evil supervillain side of things than the superhero side, because every systems administrator has an escape route. Systems administrators simply do not need to know and should not know an organisation's secret. Your job is to look after the servers. It's not to know everything. And there was always a bit of, especially early on, we had this sort of jokingly, especially with the BOFH character. Who here is familiar with that character? Okay, most of you, right? For those of you who are not, he was a fictional character who had a blog, and he talked about how he'd torture his users, and he'd get into the company secrets, and he'd say, this so-and-so was an idiot because he was reading through the executive's email and saying, well, this guy doesn't know how to run the company. And it was basically, you know, systems administrators run wild. But there was also that sort of, well, you know, I'm smarter than everybody else, so I should be able to do whatever I want. And that's really not the case anymore. Best practice is for server administrators to provide decryption tools to authorised persons and to allow those people to perform decryption tasks. And this isn't just with EFS. I'm going to talk about some other solutions where this is appropriate, where you have policy in place and someone ticks a box and says, right, go and do this. It's like with a locksmith. Locksmith turns up on-prem. You authorise them to go and open a particular safe or something like that that needs to be opened, and they're authorised to do it. A locksmith won't turn up because a criminal rings them at 3 a.m. and says, can you open the door to this house? That would be a bit problematic. Okay, so technologies, BitLocker. BitLocker protects the boot environment, operating system volumes, and fixed disks. So you turn BitLocker on, and you will notice with Windows 10 that pretty much every Windows 10 authorised device now comes with BitLocker enabled. If you go and buy yourself a Surface Pro or a Yoga Pro 3 or a Yoga 900 or an X1 Carbon, you have a look and you'll see, oh, this is already protected by BitLocker. This is pretty much almost a part of the certification process for Microsoft for these devices. So BitLocker's turned on. What BitLocker does is it fully encrypts the boot volume. If someone does not have a password to get into a machine, you can't do that old attack you used to be able to do where you'd boot off a boot disk, you'd go and hack the SAM database and reset the local administrator password and then be able to log yourself in. The idea is that with computers going forward, you will have to have a password to get onto it. If you do not have the password, the hard disk doesn't unlock. It means also that you can't just go and necessarily pull a hard disk out of a machine, put it into another machine, mount it, and then get access to the files. Why? Because everything's going to be BitLocker encrypted on that hard disk. So all of those little attacks, those little, not necessarily attacks, all of those tools that we've used to recover data aren't necessarily going to work in future. Keep that in mind. Now, BitLocker to go is an interesting one. It's designed to protect USB sticks. The idea is that you BitLocker encrypt a USB stick and then someone has to have the password whenever they plug it into another machine to unlock it. But there's another cool thing that BitLocker to go does. It can also encrypt virtual hard disk files. And you're sitting there thinking, well, why is that on earth? Is that useful? Except for a VHD file is a container file. You can use it on any supported Windows operating system, basically from Windows 8 onwards, and you can mount it like you might an ISO file. So let me show you why that's cool. Before I get to that, BitLocker and BitLocker to go support centralized recovery of data. So you remember how I showed you a data recovery agent? You can have an account that can go and recover data. So I said, oh, you couldn't pull a hard drive out and mount it. But if you've got the right certificate installed, yes, you can. And the benefit of that to your organisation is that it means that your organisation can recover data in the case that someone's Lenovo or Surface explodes and you need to pull a hard drive and get the data. But what it also means is if someone leaves their Surface or their Lenovo in the seat of the airplane and walks off, someone else can't go and pull that data out. Because one of the things that they found with lost laptops, and this is a really interesting figure, the average lost laptop costs an organisation between $30,000 and $50,000. Now you're thinking, what on earth did they buy at the Apple store for $30,000 to $50,000? The cost of the hardware is not the problem. The cost to an organisation of a lost laptop, and this is on the Ponymon website as well, so that's where I've got that data from. The cost of the thing is, what on earth was on that laptop, performing that investigation, and then working out what the value of that data was should it be exposed. If you watch certain Twitter accounts, you will see hospital records on laptop lost. 6 million health records lost. Now, you think about the cost to an there was a district in California where someone lost a laptop. It had 6 million patient records on it. Needless to say, that cost a lot more than $60,000 in terms of fines, in terms of publicity, in terms of simply having to change all of their compliance procedures. If everything, every laptop's automatically BitLocker to go encrypted, that figure goes from 30 to 50,000 down to whatever the cost of the chassis is. So that's one of the reasons that this is actually cool. But you can recover it if you've configured things properly. You can automatically have BitLocker keys written to Active Directory or on devices like a Surface or a Lenovo. You can now have them automatically written with Windows 10 to your Hotmail account. So here is where you configure BitLocker using group policy to store recovery information in Active Directory. You just simply turn this on, and then what happens is that if you need to perform a recovery, you just go into AD and you can pull the recovery key out. And that means that when you're performing BitLocker recovery, you just go, oh, I can access that data, and it'll unlock the drive. You don't have that key, you can't do that. So BitLocker to Go data recovery agent. You also have Microsoft BitLocker administration tool. You can go and download this. Yes. Okay, so if you've got users that are off-site, what you can do now is you can have you got Office 365? Okay. In that one, what you can do is before you provision them, what you can do is you can go and export those centrally. So you can still export it to a file. You can actually have it printed up on the screen where you write it out. The advantage of doing it to AD is it provides you with a centralized recovery thing where you just go and look in AD. You still can go the old version of, I'm going to go and write these strings into Excel, and should that occur, you've got the string written into Excel. So there are options for that offline as well. But these days, given that most people do have some sort of live account, you can also have them have that data written up there. Of course, they won't have any idea how to recover that, but you will. So what I want to show you is BitLocker to Go and virtual hard disks. So I said virtual hard disks were cool. Virtual hard disks are containers. Now, who here ever heard of the tool TrueCrypt? Okay, so we know that TrueCrypt got discontinued about a year ago. So what TrueCrypt would do is it would create a special encrypted container on your hard disk. You could go and put files in it, and people couldn't get those files unless it was sitting in the right container. Now, what TrueCrypt also allowed you to do is put those containers and copy them across to a USB stick, so you had an encrypted container on a USB stick and you could move it around. One of the interesting things that was said when the TrueCrypt people signed off, they said in their official statement, well, Windows does this. And I said, Windows doesn't do that. And then I thought, yeah, actually it does. So let me show you how it works. So let's say I've got really sensitive data that I'm going to store on one of my devices, that I haven't BitLocker encrypted the whole drive. In fact, because I want to back this data up, I want to be able to take this data and I want to be able to put it on a USB stick and move it around. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and create an encrypted container to store that in. And the way that I do that is I go into Computer Management, I go down to Disk Management. Then what I can do is I can go and say, I want to go and create myself a virtual hard disk. And you're thinking, this is a bit unusual. Why would he go and create a virtual hard disk? I mean, even though I write Hyper-V. So I'll go and put it here, and I will call it MS Ignite 2015. Okay, so that's going to be the file name. And then I'm going to say, okay, what are the properties of this? And what I'll do is I'll say, I'll make it a 5 gig, but I can make it however big I want. But 5 gig's not an unreasonable amount, and if I've got it certainly as a dynamically expanding hard disk, it will only consume the amount of data that I put into it. Because you think about it, you've got a lot of data that might be sitting in Dropbox or in OneDrive that you want to have access to on multiple machines, but you don't want Dropbox or OneDrive to have access to that data themselves because you want to store it in the cloud. You just want to store it in the cloud in a way that's sort of encrypted. And this gives you an option of doing that. So here I'm going, that will be fine for the properties of that. I click OK, and it goes off and creates me a virtual hard disk, which I can see down here. Okay, so disk 3 unknown, not initialized. So the first thing I need to do is go and initialize it, blah, blah, blah. Next thing I need to do is create a new volume on it. This is straightforward, you've all done this. Okay, it'll be G drive and I will call it encrypt store. Quick format's fine. I do that, bang, bang, bang. Now, what that's done is if I now go into Windows Explorer, I can see over here, if I click on this PC, that I have now got a separate mounted drive that looks like a normal removable disk. But what I can also now do is I can right-click on that and I go turn on BitLocker. I specify my password. My password is Oren's birthday, which none of you will remember. That could have done with more of a laugh, guys. Okay, so I'll put in a password. Now, what it says here is, what do you want to do with your recovery key? So think about this for your own sake, or think about it. Do I want to go and save it to my Microsoft account, save it to a USB flash drive, save it to a file, print it? If I am joined to a domain, this is not a domain joined machine, I can also have that automatically go up to Active Directory. So I'm just going to say, look, go and save it to my Hotmail account. Oh, can't save to that. Okay, so what I'll do is I'll go save to a file, and then I'll just put that on the desktop. And the reason it said I couldn't do that is because, of course, I turn off network notification. I turn off entire network when I present because I know that other presenters like to direct message you. And so it turns up on your screen as you present. So I've learnt that trick. Okay, so then I click next. Which encryption mode do I want to use? If I use new encryption, it will only be able to be decrypted on computers running Windows 10. Compatibility mode means it'll work on everything from Windows 7 Service Pack 1 onward. Click next. Ready to encrypt the drive? Yep, start encrypting. I do that. Bang. You can see now it's got a little lock on it. So I can then go and copy files across to this volume and then treat it like a normal volume on my disk. When I am finished or when I shut down the computer, that volume is automatically ejected and stays in encrypted state. So to eject the disk, you actually treat it like you would a USB drive. You right-click on it and you say eject. And I do that. So if I come then back to my file system and go to my virtual machines folder, I can see here is my MS Ignite VHD. So that's all it is. It's a 5 gig file. And in fact, you can see there, because it's got nothing into it, it's only 51,316 kilobytes. So let's say I go and create a nice file in that, and then I want to use it. I can copy that whole VHD file to another thing, because that's just my container. I double click on it, and I'll say, sorry, there's a problem mounting the file. Let's try, usually if you go and just double click on it, what it'll do is it'll say, hey, go and put in your password. So here I can go here, one second, is that F drive? No. Won't do that because that will actually, let's see if I can go and mount that again. This is a message you'd normally get. This drive is locked by BitLocker drive encryption. To open this drive, you need to unlock it first. Okay, so what would normally happen here is a little toasted come up and say, go and put your password in. So if I come back here to my Manage BitLocker control panel, I can sort of force that. You can see here it says G, BitLocker on, locked. So what I do here is I say unlock the drive. And then I put in my password. And this is the toast that normally comes up when you double click on that file. I do that, and then I come here, and we see again down here that that's just mounted as a normal volume. So where that's cool, where that's useful for you, is here's a way of basically replicating a lot of the functionality of TrueCrypt just using VHDs as storage devices. So, for example, at home, I go and put all of my tax data in a special encrypted volume like that, and then I only mount it when I need to work with my tax data. And then I go and put in my password, and then I drop that in Dropbox, because I know that that's not going to be decrypted by anybody who doesn't have my password. And BitLocker passwords are much more strongly encrypted than you would have normally. And I'm not worried about it because I've got lots of files, I've got lots of scans and things like that, and I just go and drop it in that way. Okay, so that is how you can use. Now, it doesn't hide your thing like TrueCrypt said it would, because TrueCrypt also said, well, we hide the partition, but what there was actually some pretty good attacks against TrueCrypt that could find whether or not you had a hidden partition just by looking at the entropy of the way that blocks were scattered around your data, your disk. So if anybody had wanted to find that hidden partition, they would know that it was there. I mean, if they saw TrueCrypt, they were going, guys, we know what the thing does. But there's that wonderful sort of XKCD cartoon where they're saying, here's the solution for opening TrueCrypt encrypted drives, and it was basically a hammer onto the person's knees. So this is protecting against reasonable attacks. It's not against if you get caught by the North Koreans. Okay, IPsec. I talked about copying files over your network. As we know, that is not as secure as we'd hoped. In fact, it's become a lot less secure because an increasing number of organisations use Wi-Fi for networking. Who here uses Wi-Fi in their organisation to connect? Right, okay. So there is a device called a Wi-Fi Pineapple. Who here has ever heard of this device? Oh, that's good that a number of you have. Troy Hunt, who is not presenting on the Wi-Fi Pineapple today, does a beautiful demonstration when he goes and talks at developer conferences. What he does before he starts his talk, he goes and puts his pineapple on the desk and turns it on. So it turns out that the default behavior for pretty much every mobile device is to remember networks that it's connected to in the past. So if you have ever connected to an anonymous network that doesn't require authentication, such as the one at this event, your device will remember that. Now, why that's interesting is that the way that your device finds out about those access points is it actually sends probes out into the spectrum. And it says, is the MSAU Ignite powered by Telstra Wi-Fi network around? And it'll send a probe out for that. And if it finds it, it'll connect and blah, blah, blah. What this smart, evil little device does is it listens for those probes. And then it'll say, I've heard a probe for that network. And then it'll say, it'll know from that probe that that's a network that doesn't require authentication. So what it will do is the other antenna will say, I'm that network, and your device goes, oh, cool, free Wi-Fi, and joins. And it will join without telling you. So what Troy does in these demonstrations is he just turns it on. And by about halfway through the session, a good percentage of the audience's phones have automatically gone and connected to his rogue access point without people knowing. Because people think rogue access points, well, who's going to go and join that? Well, your phone will, because it thinks it's actually a legitimate access point because it's pretending to be an access point that it's connected to before. And unless you've gone through and manually deleted all of those previous anonymous networks, your phone or your laptop or whatever will automatically go and correct. And where Troy's demonstration gets funny is that there is a thing that you can then run on the device which injects Rick Astley onto people's device. You know, like when you go and connect to the Meriton Wi-Fi or something like that, you know how it always comes up and prompts you with a web page? Well, instead of prompting you with a web page, what you can do is you can just go and push a video file down onto people's phones. And you have never seen the look of panic when you've got geeks that really think that they're on top of their security all have their phones start playing Rick Astley. So, and those things, they cost $100 and you can order them off the internet. So, think about that. Now, an attacker does not need to be in your building anymore to capture your network traffic. It's possible to compromise routers and switches to send traffic to a captured device. This is actually a common attack. You go and start intercepting traffic, or you go and get your Wi-Fi pineapple, and instead of injecting Rick Astley, all you do is you just log every packet, and then you come back in later, and then you analyse those packets for interesting bits of data. In one hack, a team posed as a photocopier repairman, they just came in and said, well, we're here to fix a photocopier in level 3, and they're like, yeah, because the photocopiers are always breaking, because that's what photocopiers do. Walked in, put it in an access point. It just looks like a little box. Now, if you see a little box with blinking lights, you might be suspicious. Everybody else that you work with is just going to go, cool, box with blinking lights. IT probably knows what that is. And it's never going to ask you about it. IPsec encrypts network traffic. You can implement domain isolation policies. What a domain isolation policy does is it's simply a special kind of firewall rule that says my device, or it's actually better to do it with servers. You just say with your servers, my server will only go and communicate with a computer that actually has a certificate issued from our CA. If the computer does not have a certificate issued from our CA, don't talk to it. With IPsec, all of your network traffic's encrypted, so even if someone's intercepting it, all they're getting is rubbish. Now, you don't need to turn that on the client computers, because your client computers might walk out of the building and go and need to use that McDonald's access point, but it does mean when they're in the building, your servers are only going to talk to authorised devices and they're going to force encrypted connections. You can keep remote users secure with commercial VPNs. Those of you who might have heard of things like Freedome by F-Secure, what you're getting is now that we know that we're connecting to all of these Wi-Fi access points, who here is connected to the Ignite access point right now? Who here is using a VPN with that access point? Okay, so some of you. Everybody else has got unencrypted data, browsing data going through. You don't know anything about this access point other than it was put in place, in theory, by people who are running this event. If you go and get yourself a secure VPN client, or even better, spin up your own VPN server in Azure, you can be fairly sure that you are not being intercepted at any point up until you've got your VPN server in Azure. I was in China, in Beijing, earlier in the year, and that was the solution to get to Twitter and Facebook, was to spin up a VPN server in Azure, and all you have to do is, how do I create a VPN server in Azure? And it takes you about 5 minutes. And then you can run it when you need. You just log onto the Azure console, turn it on, then you've got your secure VPN. People do minimal due diligence when it comes to connecting to a Wi-Fi access point. In fact, for most people, it's all free Wi-Fi. The moment you connect to a network, it can send stuff down to you. Okay, we know that because every time we connect to a network at certain hotels, it sends a web page to us that we have to sign into. There's a Hacking Team video that shows a beautiful hotel lobby Wi-Fi exploit. It's on YouTube, and basically what these guys do is they walk in with something like a pineapple, and they connect one node to the actual hotel Wi-Fi. The other one, they put up a screen that when people connect to it, it says, please put in your credit card number. You will not be charged. This is just to authenticate your connection. They sit there for an hour, and they collect something like 50 credit cards. It's not that difficult to do. Now, the best solution is to use Active Directory and Azure Rights Management Services. This is to protect your files. What they do is they apply a rights template, and you saw a little bit of this in the demo. What happens is when people create a file and you've integrated AD-RMS, what will happen is that you can encrypt the document to a particular person. And you can have it so that every document someone creates is automatically encrypted so that it can only be read by people in your organisation. If people haven't signed in with their AD account, they can't read the document. So it doesn't matter if they email it to someone, that person won't be able to open it unless they've actually authenticated with an appropriate. And then you can set other templates where someone has to manually say, okay, this is an unrestricted permission and can be sent to someone outside the organisation. And you can also control using that tool, discretionary access control, which templates apply. So if a document has a particular word in it, it will apply a particular template to it. So if it has the word hovercraft in, it will automatically apply the sensitive template. That will block the document being sent by Exchange. If they try and send it via Hotmail, that's great. They'll send it via Hotmail. They just won't be able to open it without the appropriate credentials. So, as I said, Secret and Hovercraft. You can automatically apply AD-RMS and Azure RMS templates to SharePoint. Now, why Azure RMS is cool is, unfortunately, yes, you do need an Office 365 account, but it means you don't have to set up any on-prem infrastructure to do it. What simply happens is that you configure synchronization of your local AD database into Azure, and then people can access documents wherever they are. Even if they're outside the organisation, they can put in their organisational credentials to get access to documents. So this is how you turn it on in Azure. You just go to Rights Management and you click Activate. Do you want to activate it? And the moment you do that, it will be activated in for your organisation. Now, the last one I want to talk about before we finish is Enterprise DLP, Enterprise Data Loss Prevention. You saw this in the keynote where Brad went and sent an email from an iPad to it, and then he tried to copy and paste text into an unauthorised application, and he couldn't do it. Okay, so what Enterprise DLP does is it goes further. It says this information can only be accessed by these documents, and I want to restrict what can be done. So I will allow text from Word to be pasted into Excel, but I will not allow text from Word to be pasted into a browser or into Outlook. And that stops people doing that thing where they just copy, paste text into an unauthorized application. That's coming into Windows 10. It's in preview now. It will be live probably by the end of the year. Anyway, I've covered a whole lot of technologies that you can use to protect data in transit or at rest. Please remember to complete your evaluations. If you've got any questions, please come down the front. Otherwise, you're free to leave. Thank you very much for your attention.